Today is Friday, February 10th, 2023. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Richard Tick Siegerblum. And Richard's nickname is Tick, T-I-C-K, and he spells his last name S-E-G-E-R-B-L-O-M. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Tick. How are you today?
Good.
Good. Glad to hear it. Tick, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone? Awesome.
Yeah. Tom, hold on. Just 1 second.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, are you on the call?
I am. What's up? Is there something critical? Okay. Is it a big deal? Or?
No.
Okay, good.
I just want to talk about Gilman.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we'll chat when you're done.
Okay, great.
He doesn't want to talk to you.
The dog is invading my room here. All right. Back to you.
You had very kindly talked to us about growing up in Boulder City back in the day. And I realized there was a family that I forgot to ask you about, the Jordan family, J-O-R-D-A-N. And the mom and dad, who would have been contemporaries of your mother and father, June and Jimmy, and then their children, Jimmy Jr. and Candy. And I wonder if you remember that family and have any stories, recollections about them.
You know, I remember them well, although I can't remember any particular stories. Jimmy Sr., you know, was kind of a legend. But I didn't really interact with him that much. Jimmy Jr. was, I think, a year ahead of me. I didn't really interact with him so much. I remember Candy, but just not much. Just remember her, and then remember she died very sadly and tragically and young.
Yeah, she was, 15 or so, died of brain cancer.
Yeah, just tragic thing.
And I just absolutely tragic for the family. Jimmy Jordan Sr. was a legend. How do you mean? Just that he was prominent there in town. How did you?
From my perspective, he physically stood out. I think he had a big beard, and he was just one of those, you know, kind of a character kind of person. So kind of a personality that was different than Boulder City was just so white and so government. You know, everybody was the same, and he just seemed to be, you know, have a little different bent to him.
Okay.
And his wife, June, was the nicest person, and I honestly can't remember how I interacted with her, but I seem like I interacted with her at some level quite a bit.
Okay.
They lived just, if you actually took the Belknap's house and our house, and they were like in between their house.
Oh, okay. Okay. And Jimmy Jr., he was a year older than you?
That's my recollection. It could have been two, but I think it was just one.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if he even graduated from high school. Some reason I associate him with Phoenix. I don't know. But, I didn't, you know, interact with him that much.
Okay. All right, just wanted to check that. Then in 1963, you're still in high school. Were you a junior in high school then, or?
I think I was going to be a sophomore.
Okay.
I turned 15 the day we left the Paria River.
All right. Let's back up. Can you set the stage for how that river trip all came about?
Well, I can give you my version.
Yes. Well, you're the guy on the phone.
All right. So my recollection is, you know, we used to go up in the Lower Grand Canyon, a couple of times a year, and I think it was probably this was the first year where we went up. Probably several boats would go up, several families, and the water was crystal clear. and very low. And somehow during the discussion, we said, you know, I think we've swam some rapids and just played around. And somebody said, not sure which one of us said, we ought to swim the Grand Canyon.
Okay, so let me back up a minute and fill in some questions here. This is, if you go up the reservoir behind Hoover Dam called Lake Mead, you eventually go into the western end of Grand Canyon, and it's reservoir, so it's flat water, until you start getting into the current where the river meets the reservoir level. And there's a number of side canyons, Separation Canyon and Spencer Canyon, Surprise Canyon. These canyons come in from the sides to the main river. The rapids you mentioned would be kind of fun to swim. Was that Nice Canyon or Bridge Canyon or Separation Canyon, one of those areas in there?
It is. I honestly don't remember. We would park on a sandbar.
Okay.
And spend the night, set up camp and everything, and then we'd walk up and swim out and then float through and then, do it again.
Oh, fun.
It wasn't that much water, and it wasn't rocky. It was more just a few waves. But anyway, just it was so unique having the water clear that it was very inviting.
Was it warm or warmish?
Yes. Yeah, it was warm.
Wow. So you're at, I don't know, River Mile 240, and the concept is let's put in at Lee's Ferry at River Mile Zero, and we'll have 240 miles of clear, warm, low water. Why was the river so clear and low?
My understanding is that that's when they shut the dam off and started filling Lake Powell. And it was probably early, probably like June, before the thunderstorm started to hit. And so the clear water that comes out of the dam was clear all the way to Lake Mead.
Wow. Okay, so this would have been 1963 in January, the Glen Canyon Dam turned off the bypass tubes and started releasing roughly a constant 1,000 or 1,500 cubic feet a second.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Okay, and there would have been no side tributary sediment coming in. The river would have warmed up quite a bit, I suppose. Okay, so do you remember who you were camping with that time when you were swimming and said, "Hey, this will be fun. Let's go for a longer swim."
I have to assume that the Dunlaps were with us, but there used to be like three or four families from Boulder City that would go up there and spend the weekend. And I don't know for sure that they were on this one, but the North trip would normally be the Harley West, who ran the bureau. He was head of the bureau there in Boulder City, and his family. He had a boat and a couple of kids. And then the Blues, and he ran the Bureau of Reclamation in Boulder City. And then the Millers, and Miller was like the number two guy, or one of the top guys at the Bureau.
Is that Mac Miller?
No, this is I'm blank right now. But no, Mac was not part of this whole thing.
Okay.
So he was just a guard at the Temple Bar.
Okay. All right.
So I'm pretty sure and I think, in fact, I know this was, my sister was home from college. Buzz would have been home from college. And I'm pretty sure that they were both involved because that's how it happened. You know, we were talking about it and with somebody like Buzz who could make a decision, and I'm sure we're talking about, as opposed to the rest of us, you know, really had never been through the Grand Canyon before.
Right. Now, Buzz had. Buzz knew the canyon pretty well by 1960.
Yeah, and Bill, too, obviously.
So. Oh, yeah. Yes, and Bill.
So I think it was kind of like a, you know, how, wouldn't that be fun? And then as things progress, you could, you know, start talking more and more about, you know, actually that sounds feasible. And I don't know if that was, I doubt it was on that particular trip when we made that, those kind of discussions. But then I guess at some point, you know, Bill reached out to the Bureau and you know, said, if we did this, would you pay money to have this recorded so we could make pictures for the future? And then obviously they brought Doc in. So how that all part I was not, you know, privy to, but I my recollection is anyway that I was there initially when we said, hey, wouldn't that be a great idea?
Okay. And the canyon had already been traveled through by people swimming it, Beer and Daggett, most notably in 1954. Though they were sitting on straps between big gear bags, but the water was cold, and they would go to shore and light fires and wade back in and sit on their little swing kind of hammock things and float downstream. It took them a long time. Did any of you like look at that data and figure out how they did it to figure out how you were going to do it? Or was it like, well, look, we know the canyon's there, the water's clear, the water's warm, let's just figure out how to do it?
Well, yeah, I think the initial conversation was, let's just, you know, carry a backpack or just swim down the river. And then I'm sure somebody said, well, you know, truth is you'd have to carry supplies and food and everything else.
Right.
But then it expanded to, like you said, like water wings or something, and then maybe towing a raft or something, and I don't know how far we got, but at some point, I don't know if we were talking about a boat, or I saw that little boat and said, here's what we ought to consider, but I remember that I was the one, at least Bill gave me credit for seeing the sport yak and saying, let's use that boat.
Can you describe a sport yak for me?
At the time it just seemed like a little dinghy, but instead of being made out of wood or fiberglass, it was made out of basically what I would call rubber, but I guess it's polyethylene or something. But anyway, so very pliable. So you hit a rock or hit anything, bounce, as opposed to, you know, break or jar you.
Okay.
And the truth is, what we learned about it is true. Actually, is they just took two pieces of flat polyethylene, put them into a press, and welded them together and put them in a way that had air inside.
Did they have foam inside of them, or was it air?
No, it was just there.
Okay.
I'm going to try right now to send you a picture of a picture of me rolling through a rapid when we first tried these out. I guess we bought one, took it up to the Lower Grand Canyon, just went through a rapid just to see what would happen.
And how did you have to like go out and buy these things?
I'm assuming, I honestly don't know how that came to be, because they, you know, we had to get seven of them. So what it was my recollection was there was one at the Lake Mead Marina. And I don't know if it was for sale or it was just sitting there or something. But anyway, I saw it and said, that would be great. And then I guess somebody followed up on that, and Bill probably reached out to it. It was made by a company called, I just texted you this picture, but company called Dayton, something or other, and they, so I'm sure he must have reached out and said, you know, we'd like to do these, and then there was a deal probably made where they sent us 10 or whatever we ended up having.
Okay, as a promo, so they would get some press.
I think so. I mean, I know they got a lot out of it afterwards, but I don't know if they were smart enough to know at the time what we were talking about. And we just bought 10 of them. I think they were only like $100 a piece or something.
So did they, how did you steer them? Like with a little canoe paddle?
No, we had oars.
Okay.
And there was no, I don't know if you've seen the ones, the modern ones, but we ended up putting up splash shields on the front and the back and had a little built-in fiberglass storage container in the front and everything. But these were just like rowboats. And the picture I just sent you, you can see there's oars. And the oars actually had a fixed pin through them, so they couldn't come in and out. And that broke the first day when we went down the river.
Wait, so explain this to me. How do you mean?
Well, there's an oar lock attached to each side of the boat.
Yep.
On each side. And then in the oar lock was a pin, and that went right through the middle of the oar.
Oh.
So the oars couldn't go in or out.
Okay.
And it made it real easy to row because you didn't have to worry about holding on to them. But I think the first day on the river, those pins popped.
Oh, my.
That's when Bill and Buzz actually hiked out and came back with new supplies. And that's when it could have been that we actually learned that before the trip, but it seems to me that was what we discovered the first day of the trip.
So it wasn't that the oar broke because it had a hole drilled through the middle of it. It was the pin that went through the middle of the oar that attached to the oar locks that would break.
Yeah.
So was it a matter of just trying to get stronger pieces of steel to make that happen?
No, I think we just got rid of the pin and created used some baling wire and made the what was a half U-shaped oar lock, made it a circle so that the oar could go in and out, but it wouldn't pop out, and then put on the oar itself leather.
Oh, like a leather wrap to make an oar stop?
Yeah.
So that the oar would sit against the lock without sliding down or sliding out.
Well, and I don't even know if we had that much or we just had stuff on the oar.
Okay.
It's hard to believe we could do that in a day after the first day. But maybe we did. I just remember we got to Badger or somewhere, and after the first day, and we'd already broken a couple of oar locks, and so Bill and Buzz hiked out, and somehow had got material and hiked back in, and we fixed them up and went on again.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. So you're credited with saying, "Hey, that's a cool little boat. We could use that." How big are these sport yaks, roughly, just size-wise?
I want to say 7 feet by, say, 3 feet.
So the size of my bathtub.
Essentially, that's pretty much what it looks like and what it is.
So you've got to carry, you're going to carry a sleeping bag and a cook pot and then some food. So now you've got to carry maybe a backpack with all that stuff in it?
Yeah, and what I think we did was we created, with ropes in the front of the boat, so you could stuff stuff under the ropes, crisscrossing the bow of the boat, so you stuff stuff under there. And then we had waterproof bags, like army surplus, they were army surplus, but whatever you call it, what the army called them, where we had several of those, each person had a couple of those.
The generator bags, the kind of black rubber, you'd fold them all up, and they were pretty good about it.
Everybody paid some silver.
Okay,
I'm pretty sure that's what we used. There, I remember we had a specific thing, I can't remember what it was, that we had found, we did my family, I can't even think of the name now, but anyway. That were also waterproof that you would roll up, and that we put, I know my dad had his art supplies in there, and I can't remember what else. And then we had like each we made meals and put those in plastic sacks for each meal, and those were stuffed in something. So I mean, we had plans, but I think the plan was for 10 days worth of food, and by 10 days we got to Phantom Ranch.
Okay, so in the planning stage, who wanted to go?
Well, I remember my sister and Buzz were very thought that was a great idea.
Okay.
And I assume that for better or worse, Bill and my dad said okay, and then I was included somehow. But I just remember, and my sister probably had a better memory. She may have been the one that came up with the idea and pushed it. But it was definitely a more of a college lark than it would be. You know, somebody my age wouldn't be sophisticated enough to think of the idea, but I would certainly game for anything.
So if that ball started rolling, and so you've got five people already. You got Buzz Belknap, his dad Bill, your sister Robin, your dad Cliff, and you. That's five people. Who else was on the trip?
And, you know, truthfully, I'm not sure where Loie was, but and why she didn't go. I remember she didn't want to go, but I don't know if she was with us when we first talked about it, and then she may have changed her mind, or she wasn't even on the trip up the river.
Okay.
But so then it was Doc Marston, who I'm sure Bill reached out to and convinced her, maybe didn't even have to convince him. And then Mac Miller, and I'm not sure how Mac, how he got included in that, because we didn't know him at all, but
okay.
I guess the Belknaps knew him from he'd been a park ranger, I think, at Temple Bar, but how they knew him beyond that, I'm not sure.
All right. Okay, so was the idea to resupply with food at Phantom? So the 10...
No. The idea was we were going to get through in 10 days.
Wow.
And so we just took 10 days worth of food.
All right. Going to be going fast. Okay. So the summer is... It starts in June. Hey, look at those. Maybe we could swim this thing July, August. Now, you've got to go back to school, and the summer is rapidly progressing. When did you all finally get up to Lee's Ferry with the boats and the gear, the food, the bags, all that stuff?
Well, we left August the 5th. So I think, or not, we left August the 4th.
Okay.
So, I guess we got there August the 3rd or August the 2nd. And when we got there, you know, I said in the plan for this, the river was, and so we jumped over a little bit. I'll give you more details whether you want it or not. But anyway, so we had the first trip, start talking about wouldn't it be fun to swim, go back, think more about it, think how we're gonna carry all the stuff. I find the boat. So the other question is how would the boat work? So then we took the boat. Bought a boat or got a boat and took it up on the jet boat and in the lower Grand Canyon and tried it actually in the river to see how it went through the rapids.
How did it work?
Fine. And that's why I said, I just sent you I forget the text, but I sent you a picture of me in the sport yak. This was before we went down the river.
Okay.
Just testing it out.
Okay.
But so anyway, then the boat seemed to go great. So then said, okay, let's go. So I ended up, instead of swimming, we were all going to have a boat. And that worked out. So we go to Lee's Ferry. We have our boats all laid out. Everything's ready to go on the side of the river. The river is crystal clear. And the night before we leave, the rain starts huge. The Faria River floods. We almost lost our boats because the Colorado River went so high.
Oh, wow.
We pulled them in, And there's literally a picture where you can see the beautiful Colorado River coming down, and then the Paria joining it, with just as muddy as could be.
Oh.
And just, you know, by the end of the Paria riffle, the river is the Colorado River. You know, too thick to drink and too thin to plow.
Got it.
So we never saw the water.
So the dreams of blue swimming was dashed. Oh,
yeah,
my gosh.
The whole theory of the trip was over before it started.
Huh. Well,
it was really thick. I mean, the water was so low, and it was rainstorming every day. And so it was, I don't know if you ever saw, there's a picture of my sister holding her, holding her socks. And they were just looked like two pieces of driftwood because they're just stiff as can be.
Wow. Wow. Huh. There's a picture I saw of Doc, I think, on a radio. A handheld kind of walkie-talkie, sort of a big thing. And I think he's at the Navajo Bridge or someplace near there. And that might have had something to do with the oars breaking.
Yeah, I think that's probably after that, because I don't think we even got to the Navajo Bridge, but maybe we did. But anyway, the reality is my mother, Fran, and Mac Miller's wife were in cars or trucks or something, and they were following us on the rim.
Okay.
And we had walkie-talkies. And so at the end of that first day when we had this disaster with the oars, they called up and said, you know, we need some help. And so they hiked out and met them and did whatever they did. But then throughout the trip, we would be talking to them, you know, I don't know if during the day, but at least every night, by walkie-talkie, what's going on.
Oh, wow.
I just remember, this is kind of off the head, but you'd have to know Fran Bell not to remember this, but by the end of the 10th day, we were trying to get to Phantom Ranch. And, I remember Bill saying something to Fran about, I don't know if we're going to make it. And she's saying, but Billy, they're expecting you. Or I think she called it Willie. But Willie, they're expecting you. Anyway, it was like, hello, we're half dead and we're trying to get we're not going to worry about dinner reservations.
Oh, gee. So, what do you remember about that first day on the water, besides that you broke, that there were troubles with the oar locks? What else do you remember about that? You've got the Paria coming in, it's muddier than a skunk, and then you start floating down to, I'm assuming, but I don't know, the first rapid, in quotes, would have been a Cathedral Wash.
Yeah, I honestly don't remember any of that stuff. I just remember, we parked on the left side going downriver, and it was historically a known rapid. You know, the known rapids when we ran into them, they were just rock piles. So I mean, the bigger rapids were actually hadn't even been rapids before, but the big rapids that everyone knew about were just big rocks.
So I'm thinking like Badger. Badger would be the first.
That's what I would say Badger without knowing where Badger was, but that's something that sticks to my mind. So we pulled the boats through that rapid and parked at the bottom, and then they hiked out. But I don't, I also don't remember during the day, but I just know that every time we hit a rapid, it wasn't like we went through the rapid, we would stop, look at it, and then basically pull or line the boats through the side of the rapid.
Okay, so lining, that's with a rope to the front and the back of the boat?
Yeah, and so you stand on the shore and then you hold the boat, let the boat go down. And that was, you know, good in theory, but I think at the end of the day, it was mainly just pulling them.
Hmm. Did you leave your river bags in the boat, or would you take those out and walk those down the shore?
No, I think we left them in.
Okay. And did you do a lot more walking than you intended?
I don't think so, because, I mean, it was the rapids aren't that big.
Okay.
I mean, what it was basically, it was a rapid, a lake, a rapid, a lake.
Oh, wow.
Rapid would just, was like a dam. And so, you know, for a mile or two behind it, it was just flat water. And then, of course, in the afternoon when the wind comes up, you're just trying to row against the wind to get to the next rapid was a lot of work.
But oh, wow.
Current. So, it was, that's why it was so slow.
Yeah, because the river was, what, fairly wide? I mean, 60, 70 feet wide and only 1,000 cubic feet a second, or maybe 2,000?
Yeah. So, anyway, it wasn't what we thought was going to be just a leisurely float down the river with the current taking us.
Huh. And camping just right along the shore at night?
Yeah. Yeah, but the other thing, you know, there were huge, huge sandbars and huge driftwood. I mean, for miles of just these huge stacks of driftwood.
Wow.
Just amazing.
Huh. And raining with a monsoon rain still pounding on you?
Yeah, I don't recall, like, you know, like 24/7 or anything, but it just seemed like that we had ponchos and wearing ponchos. But compared to some trips I've had since then on the Green River, it wasn't like overwhelmingly rainy,
okay.
Not just the side canyons, but we're flooding, or maybe it was just the Prairie was still running.
Sort of the typical monsoon.
Yeah, in August, you know, August on the Grand Canyon is pretty rainy.
Right, right. Let's see. It sounds like when you guys got to the Marble Canyon Dam site, the Arizona Power Authority was actually in there working that dam site, and they had a helicopter that was coming and going there and landing on a floating a flat platform there to bring in supplies in and out. Do you remember anything about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a shocker, because we get there and there's a helicopter. And but here's what's so interesting. So I think we talked about this before, but my mother and father had gone to Panama during World War II, and they're actually, I think I'm really getting into something a little confused, but anyway, some of their best friends in Panama had children, and one of the guys, the engineers working on this dam site, was the son of this family from Panama.
Oh, wow.
Panama. And I even think, and this is where I may be just stretching things, but I think maybe their daughter was named Robin. That's how my sister got her name.
Oh, my gosh. Huh.
But anyway, just, I mean, talk about randomness of all the places in the world. But
yeah. So, and he was working for the state of Arizona at the time. As part of that project.
Yeah, or Bechtel, or whoever was, probably had contracted with him.
Okay, do you remember his name at all?
I don't.
Okay, all right. What else do you remember about that operation?
About the helicopter?
Yeah, the helicopter and the dam site. Did you guys get out, and did they give you a tour and walk you around, or...
Yeah, I don't think I rode on it, but I think I know Buzz did, and I think a couple of other people may have ridden on the helicopter, and I'm not sure if they went up to the rim, but I assume they did.
Okay.
I don't know if we stayed the night there, but we spent quite a bit of time.
Okay. All right. And then downstream of that, let's see, wait a minute. I get my upstreams and downstreams figured out here. Upstream of that, I got my upstreams and downstreams a little tangled. Vasey's Paradise and Redwall Cavern. And upstream of that a little more, there's a place called the Fence Fault. And I've heard rumors there's a spring there, and that you guys were able to see an awful lot of water tumbling into the river right there. Do you remember that at all?
No.
Okay. This is up above Vasey's Paradise and Red Wall Cavern a ways. I'll look in the journals and the letters for that, see if there's any record of that.
Yeah, I'm sure Doc had written that. I'm sure there's pictures somewhere, too.
Was Doc keeping notes on the trip and writing in his trip log?
Yes.
Okay.
I remember every night or every morning, or maybe both, but I remember he would always sit there and have a book open and writing things.
Okay.
At the time, I think he was 67 or how old he was, but at the time, he seemed old, but now that I'm this age or older, it's unbelievable what kind of shape he was in. And that's, to just be able to, it really was very physical.
Okay. Do you remember flipping your boat over? Did anybody have any flips? And again, we'll just stick to the timeline here. Started in Badger and then Soap and then down North Canyon and House Rock and or the other way around. And then the Roaring Twenties. There's a whole bunch of what would have been rapids and lakes.
Yeah, I'm not sure when the first flip happened. I recall several flips, but I remember, again, I think it's the last day before Phantom Ranch, and I could be wrong, but somewhere toward the end of our 10 days, Robin flipped and was stuck under her boat for a little while, and that kind of...
Right, I bet. Before we get to that story, there's a picture I saw. Your dad was doing some great artwork on that trip. And at Nankoweap, maybe a little Nankoweap, somewhere in there, the main Nankoweap area, helicopter came in and I think brought you guys some food. Do you remember that?
I don't.
Okay. All right. And then at the confluence with the Little Colorado River, do you remember that at all?
I remember that, but I don't remember anything other than that. I want to say, and this may be totally crazy, that somehow or other we thought that would be blue, and that wasn't even blue.
Right. Okay, that gives us a sense of the energy of the monsoons that summer.
Yeah, but again, I could be totally wrong, because I have a beautiful picture my father painted, but it wasn't from that trip, but of the Little Colorado coming in and showing the turquoise water going, you know, coming out and merging with the regular river.
Right, with the main Colorado.
Yeah, it's just gorgeous.
And then down to Unkar, that area. Trip was going well. You know, were you having fun with Robin and Buzzy?
I think so, but I mean, honestly, it was a lot of work.
How so?
Well, you had to row, you got to rapid, you had to get out, you had to scout it, then you had to pull the boats through the rocks, and you get back in the boat and row some more. So, I mean, it was not, I mean, I wouldn't say I was exhausted or because, you know, I was young and physical wasn't a big deal, but, but I wouldn't say it was like party time, because it wasn't party time.
Okay. And did you joke a lot, or were people grumbling just because it was a lot more work than what they remembered?
I think we were just all... You know, it's like an adventure, so you did it all. So I don't think it was people were complaining, but
it was work. It wasn't play anymore. Now that it was really happening, it was work.
Yeah, because I mean, again, it was like the thought was we're going to be, you know, you get in the boat and and the current takes you down, and you just sit there and watch the look around. And the truth is, you rode a lot.
So you had to work to make the miles.
Yeah.
So the scenery was going by, but you were working for it.
Exactly.
Okay. And then, did you flip your boat at all?
You know, I don't recall that, but I can't answer that. I just don't know.
Okay. But Robin did. What do you remember about that?
Well, again, I don't know how many times she did it. And but I do remember the last time, which is right toward the end. And just she flipped it and was caught under the boat. I'm not sure how long, but I just know enough to scare her. And that was kind of other than that, everything's were. I mean, we were working, but it wasn't that didn't ever feel dangerous. I think that made her really be worried.
Okay. And Robin was, as you mentioned, she was a competitive swimmer.
Right.
So she was a very strong swimmer.
Yeah, and you know, she was 20 years or 18 or 19 years old. I mean, but anyway, it, when you're stuck on something like that, and maybe you don't know if you're going to pop up or not. But when you talk to her, you can find out more. That's my recollection. She was worried. But
okay. And you guys were all wearing life jackets.
Yeah.
Okay. And then eventually you would have made it to Phantom Ranch.
Right.
And what happened then?
We got there. I think we were supposed to get there at night. But I think we didn't make it. I think we made it the next day, maybe noon or something. Took our boats out. I don't know. I guess we must have left them there by the river. And then went up to the Phantom Ranch. I don't recall spending the night, but I we probably did. Probably had some food and stuff. But that's when the decision was, do you want to leave or not leave? And I don't know when those discussions had taken place, but I just remember I was probably the last one to make up my mind whether to go or not go. And I said, yeah, I want to go walk out.
Okay. So who left and who stayed?
Robin and my dad and I left, and the other four stayed.
Okay. And did they get a resupply of food then, or?
Yeah, there must have been that part I don't really recall, but I'm sure there was a ton more food came down.
Okay. How did you get your sport yaks out?
We put them on the mules, and there's great pictures of, I think, one on each side.
Okay.
I guess there were in three, so it would have been one mule had two, and one mule just had one.
Okay.
But I have to look at the picture again, but my recollection is they were... The bottoms of the boats were out, and the rest part of the place where you sit was up against the mule.
Hmm. Okay. All right. That must have been an interesting and challenging job for the packers. Huh.
Yeah. I mean, those guys know what they're doing. So.
And so your mom and Fran, and Mac Miller's wife were then up on the rim. And then did they give you a ride home in? How did that work out?
I honestly don't recall, but I'm sure that's, I think we probably, I assume we spent the night there and drove home, but.
Okay. All right. And did you try to kind of keep your ear to the wire to see how the rest of the trip was going for those guys?
I honestly don't remember that.
Okay. And they would have popped out in Western Grand Canyon. Did somebody motor up and pick them up?
I'm sure they did, but it wasn't me.
Okay.
So I don't know how that thing happened.
Okay. All right. So this was a sophomore in high school.
Yeah, I was starting my sophomore year, and as soon as I got back, football practice started, and I was off to the races.
Okay. And you got good at football.
Yeah, relatively speaking, yes. Not necessarily that year, but later on.
Right. And I think we talked about your high school days, and then for college, and kind of moving forward here, you mentioned going to Claremont?
Pomona.
Okay.
Claremont. I played football there first couple of years.
And did you get a scholarship for that?
No, they didn't have, it's not an athletic place, so.
Okay.
They don't give you scholarships.
Why did you choose that school?
My sister had gone there.
Oh, okay.
And it was one of those things where I used to go visit her and like what I saw. And
okay.
So it wasn't even a decision, just like a good place to go.
What were you studying?
I went as a math major, ended up as a philosophy major.
Okay. The philosophy of mathematics.
Yeah, well, I would go that far. Basically, I just trying to graduate. It was during the Vietnam War, and I dropped out, and there was lots of things going on.
So if you dropped out during the Vietnam War days, then you would have been a good candidate for getting drafted.
Yeah, and I was. I shouldn't say that. I joined Vista. I was Vista volunteer. They said that you can't do that, so you have to go back to school. I went back to school. They let me finish the 4 years. And then that's when they had the lottery where you had to pick a number, or everybody got a number based on your birthday.
Okay.
And so my number was so high that I would have been drafted. So I applied to be a conscientious objector. And I don't remember how it worked out. Well, I think I applied and said because I was a philosophy major, and I said I don't believe in war. And they wrote back and said, sorry, but that's not an excuse. And so right around that time, the Supreme Court said that no, you don't. It's not just religion, that you can have a fundamental belief in pacifism or whatever you want to call it. You don't have to believe in God.
Uh-huh.
So I wrote back and said, you can't exclude me just because I don't believe in God. And so they said, okay, come in. So I went in for an interview. They had like a panel of three people or five people, just local people here in Las Vegas. And they asked me questions, and I answered the questions. And it shocked me, but next thing I know, I get a letter saying that they accepted my conscious objection.
Okay. Do you remember what kind of questions they asked?
I don't, but I remember the big one was, if somebody was attacking your mother, what would you do? And I said, I would defend her. That's why I don't want to go to war. I mean, I don't want to be put in a position where I have to make those kind of decisions.
Right, there is a difference.
Well, I don't know.
Huh. Okay. And so did you get your philosophy degree?
Yes, I graduated a semester extra. And that's when I went, then I went to work for Bill when he had Grand Canyon Expeditions. I was in, they had just moved to, can I have?
What year did you graduate?
It would have been end of 70, or actually, like the semester went till January, so it would have been like January of 71.
Okay. And let's set the stage here. I'm looking at the time here, and I'm thinking we're getting close to a break point here. So Bill Belknap got into river running.
Yeah, he there was a what's his name? The last name Smith.
Is that Ron Smith?
Ron Smith, right. So Ron obviously much younger, but he had started a company, Grand Canyon Expeditions, and I think Bill had used them for a National Geographic tour or something. So that's how they met, and they became very close. And Ron was looking to expand, and so brought Bill in, and Bill really professionalized and Fran too. They both moved to Salt Lake, and really professionalized the operation and helped them expand. And then
so expand meaning Ron was running one river in one place, and then Fran and Bill helped him expand to run more rivers in other places?
I think more expand in Grand Canyon. I think this probably not real familiar with, but I think they would probably, start in Lodore in the spring, and then do Cataract in May or June, and then go down to the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
But it was just when the river itself was starting to become much more popular. So, and I'm not sure, I don't think he invented it, but I think he was one of the first people, Ron, to have the round or the oblong tube with the two pontoons on the side with the pointed up. He was part of that group that invented that or created that.
Right. And I think that kind of kicked in gear in the 60s with the Sanderson folks, but maybe not. I mean, there were a lot of people that were running that type of boat with a long, thin oval, and then a kind of a snout tube on either outrigger outside of that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if Ron had worked for somebody who had that, but remember, it was that kind, then there was the other kind, I can't remember the name of the guy. They were all like tubes with a snout on them, like four or five of those tied together.
Which was attributed to Jack Curry of Western River.
Yeah, Western Rivers, that's what it was.
Okay.
Yeah, there was just a couple of companies that did it. So Ron and Bill were partners, and based out of Salt Lake. And then Ron bought this huge warehouse in Kanab. It was an old lumber mill. And so they all moved down there. And I remember when I graduated, I had worked, I think, a summer before. I'm pretty sure I worked the summer before when they were in Reno, or when they were in Salt Lake, then I went to Kanab in early 71.
What do you remember about that summer? That would have been the summer of 1970 in Salt Lake.
That may have been, and I could be wrong, but that may have been when Bill, Ron let Bill start his own sport yacht trips.
Okay,
and I was with I was around the first one of those, but I probably was where they actually had would hire a lot of people individually contract to come out and go on a sport yacht trip, and so I remember doing that for I'm pretty sure I would have been on the his first one of those.
And where, what river section were you guys running?
That was Desolation.
Okay.
And we started the first one or couple, we started, I forget the name of the place, but we ended up starting San Wash, but before that we started farther up, and it was just like one day of just incredible mosquitoes, just flat water.
Yeah.
Just a nightmare. And once you figure out you put it in San Wash, it made the trips a lot better.
Oh, so you guys were putting it at Ouray in the Uinta Basin?
Yeah, where the road crosses there.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was horrific.
U-I-N-T-A is how Uinta is spelled for the transcribers. Yeah, the mosquitoes are horrific in there, and it's all flat water for miles and miles and miles. Wow.
Yeah, and you know, you're putting people who've never been rode a boat in their own boat and tell them, okay, off we go. The first couple of days is just people just spinning around in circles. And but you know, we would go, at least then there was current, so the boats would move, but it was. It was definitely a learning curve. But amazing, by the third day, most people knew how to row.
Okay. So that kind of worked out okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, I did a couple of summers, and those were definitely fun. I mean, it was something different. No one had ever tried it where everybody had their own. Paying customers had their own boat, and of course the Green River was like the Colorado used to be, with big sandbars and driftwood and not that many boats, and you could swim the rapids. Anyway, it was really fun.
Wow! So the water would have been warm.
Yeah.
Huh. And how many of these you guys were running the sport yaks?
Right.
How many would you have on a trip?
I think we had maybe up to 20. We had one rubber raft, what we call the Green River. I'm not sure what size that was, but somebody wanted to grow that. With that, had all the supplies in it, and then everybody else just had their own sport yak.
Okay. So were people carrying, like when you guys did the Grand Canyon with your sport yaks? You had a couple bags that were your stuff, your camping kit. Did you guys run that same deal there in Desolation where?
Yeah, you would have, at that point they figured out what they call a yak pack, which is any of these fiberized things that fit in the front of the boats, had a top on them that was not totally leak-proof, but pretty leak-proof.
Okay.
And so that people would put their own gear in there, and I think we'd spread some of the food around sometimes. Then they had a separate bag that had the sleeping bag in it, one of those waterproof bags, and that was tied up in the back of, in the stern of the boat.
So that way the Green River, the baggage boat, if you will, wasn't totally swamped with, you know, 20 bags of sleeping bags and all kinds of other stuff, but would have been pretty heavy just carrying food in the kitchen.
Right.
Okay. What kind of flows did you get back then? Was it, you know, sort of regular summer flows, you know, I don't know, 5 to 10,000, something like that?
It could be in May and June, early June, it could be 10 to 20,000.
Okay.
But it could be pretty high, but by August it was, you know, down to a couple of thousand.
Okay. All right. And that was your first summer with Grand Canyon Expeditions was doing sport yak trips.
Right.
Okay. Well, we've been talking for just about an hour here. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series, and we will pick up 1971 on the next oral history. What do you think?
If you're willing to keep listening, I'll keep talking.
That sounds good to me. Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead and conclude this oral history then. Today is Friday, February 10th, 2023. This will conclude part two of a Grand Canyon oral history with Tick Siegerblum. My name is Tom Martin, and Tick, thank you so very much.
Thank you. And I don't know if you'll be able to see it, but I texted you this picture from the, it was the Dayton, the guys that made the Sporting Act, they had a brochure that had a picture of me and Ron, the Sporting Act, and that was from when we first tried the Sporting Acts in the lower Colorado before we used them on the trip.
Oh, cool. I'll look forward to that. That'll be fun. Okay, hang on a second.